come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together, we get better. In person, January 12th through 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, weekend-long big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, plus a boutique where you can shop till you drop. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at a discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website, and act fast because rooms sell out quickly. There is a solution. You'll hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together, we get better.
Welcome to the OA Light and Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you will find several speaker feeds with over 800 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep the special service active. The opinions expressed on the Light and Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Tim C.
Hi, I'm Tim, compulsive overeater. Just to get the numbers out of the way, back from relapse, abstinent 14 years, and I'm down 106 pounds. And I always say the exact number for the month because my disease loves the gray areas. It loves vagueness. It likes to live in the dark corners of my food program. So what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And okay. Excellent. I'll make sure I have plenty of time for questions and shares. Let's see. I did not grow up. I was always a little heavy set, but never. I was never obese as a kid. We grew up, and now that was for two reasons. We grew up on a working farm, so there was always work to do, and we were always played a sport. So we were always kind of doing something. We were either working for my dad out in the field or at his company, and so. I really did feel part of out on the farm. I really did feel like it was a very chaotic family. Don't get me wrong. There was five kids and two parents. And just to qualify, out of the seven of us, four had gastric bypass, and it worked for them. And they've been able to keep their weight off, and it worked for them. And I found this solution. I found this solution before. I got big one time, and I found this solution. It wasn't until I got to high school that I really noticed that I ate different, because all the kids that were out near me ate exactly like, we all ate big breakfast, we would go and work all day long, and then we would come back and eat big dinners. And my older cousins, I remember going to a restaurant and being able to eat as much as my older cousins. And I was like, oh my God, that was like, and they would say, hey, look at Tim. He can eat as much as his older cousins. And I was like, oh, great. I got a pat on the back for that. So that's what, that was good. I'll eat. And I did that really well. I remember the first time I ever used food to change my feelings, was when I was about in sixth grade and I started to notice girls, and the girl that I liked didn't like me. And, nobody taught me this, but I went home, I got the toaster out, I got a loaf of bread out, I got the butter out, and the assembly line began. And before I became aware of it, the whole loaf of bread was gone. And I could eat it as fast as it came off the assembly line. And my mom came home and she's like, you ate a whole loaf of bread? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, you still have to eat dinner. She's like, you still have to eat. And I was like, no problem, I'll eat dinner. And I did, it wasn't a problem. And so when I got to high school, we were kind of like the Beverly Hillbillies. I'm dating myself on that one. We moved from the farm to the city, and I went from a very small parochial school to a very big parochial school, and I didn't know anybody. And I fit in on the farm. I really fit in there. I was a hard worker, and I was always praised for that. I was good at sports, and I was a hard worker, and I was always praised for that. When I got to high school, I did not keep up with everybody in the sports category. I didn't like the work. This was a very smart school, and I didn't like school. And they were all drinking. And when I left that school, when I left that small parochial school, I remember telling my friends three things. I don't want to drink, I don't want to smoke, and I don't want to have premarital sex. And smoking went away that, like when I was a freshman. You know, it took till about my sophomore year to the peer pressure to drink, I would drink. And then it took a couple years and I finally got the third one down. And so I need to fit in. I really need to fit in. And I struggled to find a place to fit in. And it wasn't until I got here. And actually, even after, I didn't get it right away, but I'll get to that part of it. So what did they do? They drank. And I was like, well, I'll drink too. I mean, it's my parents were like, yeah, drink if you want. We don't care. And so I did. I drank and I liked it. I liked the effect produced by alcohol. I love it. It made me feel free. After a couple drinks, it made me free. And from the time I started drinking till the time I was 29 years old, I drank alcoholically, and it kind of pushed the pause button on food. Just kind of pushed the pause button because I could get the relief that I needed from life with a couple drinks of beer. Now, again, I might overdo it. I might drink and totally wreck the party, but that's what, you know, it didn't bother me. My drinking never bothered me. It bothered other people, but, you know, I that's a small price to pay. So at 29, something happened, and one day I was a drinker, and the next day I was not a drinker. Now, this is an important part of my story, because it comes up later in my relapse. So, literally, one day, just it disappeared. From the time I was 28, 29 years old, I can't remember the day, because it's not a very important date in my life. Something happened where all of a sudden, the way I drank, it just became silly. It just became, and I was like, oh, and I turned to the girl that I was with, and I would say, I said, I will never drink again. And I literally turned and got up, and she did ask one question. She says, well, not even on vacation? And I'm like, no, I'm done. And I got up, and I just walked out of the bar. And I have never, from that moment, I drink of alcohol. And it was easily brushed aside. And so, you know, even during my relapse, the thought of having a drink never occurred to me. And that was 25, 26 years ago, something like that. But what happened after that? After the alcohol was gone, all of a sudden the food was right. That was the only way I could seek relief. Now, again, the pause button was off, and I gained a lot of weight really fast. And, you know, I am a very prideful person still to this day. That is the pride that leaves the character defect, and I can justify and rationalize my pride in looking good in many, many ways. So I gained about 60 pounds in a short 4 to 6, 8 months, something like that. And I gained the weight so quickly, my back seized up on me in the middle of like a busy intersection here. And so I'm waddling, trying to get out. It seized up in the middle of the road. And I'm trying to get out, and the cars are honking, and I'm trying to, and I got to the corner. I had to stop. And I was like, I was embarrassed. And I'm like, something's got to change. And so the only way I knew how to lose weight was through exercise. Now, I played lots of sports, but I never exercised. And I hated exercise, but I was going to try it then. So I went out and exercised, and I didn't run a 5K. I've never run a 5K, never run a 10K. I ran marathons. I said, okay, I'll just run a marathon. I just signed up for the Chicago Marathon. I ran the Chicago Marathon, no problem. And did really well. Was running through a lot of pain, dropped the weight, was looking good again. And, you know, and then I was like, what's next? Because I knew if I stopped, I wasn't going to go to and do a 5K. I needed something more. I'm like, well, the Ironman Triathlon, that's out there. That's pretty good, right? I'll do that. And so sure enough, I called them and I said, hey, I want to do the Ironman. They're like, well, you have to qualify to do the Ironman. I said, I don't want to do a half. I just want to do the full one and get it over with. And they're like, well, people, you don't do that. And I'm like, well, I want to do that. And I want, now me as an addict, I want special rules for me. I want special rules. And I'm like, is there no way that you'll let me do this? And they're like, well, you know what? We need volunteers. So if you send us $1,000 so we can pay some volunteers, we will let you do it. I'm like, done. I wrote them a check for $1,000, and I was off. I didn't even have a bike, and I'd never swam before. And I knew if I stopped, there was something wrong with me and food. And I knew if I stopped, the weight was coming back on. So I did the Ironman. It was great. I'm literally coming back from upstate New York, beautiful, Lake Placid, coming back. And I'm thinking, what's next? I'm thinking, what's next? And this is into thin air was out. So this is the late 90s. I'm thinking, I'm going to climb Everest. I'm going to climb Everest. So I'm like, hey, I want special rules again. So I call them up and I'm like, hey, how much does it cost to climb Mount Everest? And they're like, you give us a check for $80,000, we will get you up Everest. And I'm like, click. I did. And I was like, I can't afford $80,000. And I'd never climbed a mountain, but I knew there was something wrong with me. And so I'm like, within 2 months of finishing the Ironman, I'm heading out to California, following my dreams in California, because I love starting over. I love new. I love exciting. I'm not a trudger. I'm not a continuer. I'm not a seeker. I'm a new. I like new. I like new relationships. I like new jobs. I will tear my life apart and start over at the drop of a hat. At the first sign of difficulty, this sucked. I never wanted to do that anyway. The girl needs to be new. The job needs to be new. The apartment needs to be new. Now, my godfather, God love him, he unfortunately died from this disease, was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, sober a long time, but could not get this. He could not get this. He could not get abstinent. He pulled me aside and he goes, Tim, he goes, I think you're going to do great out there. He goes, you know, you are a hard worker and you will do really well out there because everybody's looking for hard workers. He goes, but at some point you're going to have to stop and find you. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about, man. I'm like, what kind of mumbo jumbo you're talking there? I'm like, when I get to California, I'll be in California, you know? And he's like, okay. And sure enough, he was absolutely right because I got here, and when everything was exciting and everything was new, it was easy to walk away from the candy and from the starches and from the popcorn and from all those things. But as soon as the job wasn't new anymore, as soon as the girl wasn't exciting anymore, as soon as the town wasn't fun anymore, I started seeking relief. I started seeking relief from exactly what my uncle had said, from me. And so I am starting to gain weight. And what do? I'm a crafty little son of a bitch. I trick my brothers and sisters into running a marathon so now I can use competition. Now I can use competition to get to lose the weight. So it wasn't just enough for me to do it myself. I've got to go now beat these unsuspecting saps, first timers. I'm going to beat them. Now again, this is just sick thinking, but I don't care. This is the best thinking I bring to the table, right? And so, sure enough, my family's well. They're supportive. They all show up in Chicago to root us back on. I fly from LA back into Chicago, but I'm starting to skip runs because it's no longer new and fun. It's no longer exciting. I'm starting to skip training sessions. I'm starting to not run so much. And during this time, I met this guy, and he said to me, "I was like, man, we went to dinner." And I was like, you know, I just can't stop eating. I'm eating these foods, and once I start eating them, I can't stop eating them. And I don't think I said it like that, but he kind of intuited it, that I had a problem with food. And he goes, oh, you remind me of me. And now he's sitting across from me at 6'2", 180 pounds. I'm on my way back up to 280, right? And I'm like, well, what did you do? Because, of course, I want the answer. I don't want a cure. I want the diet. He goes, I went to Overeaters Anonymous. And I'm like, of course, since my godfather was in AA, I knew everything about 12-step program, right? So, of course, just by osmosis, I said, yeah, I don't need a spiritual program to stop eating, you know? And he goes, well, I did. And I'm like, okay, perfect. I went off to Chicago. I get there. My whole family's going to get together and go to dinner the night before the marathon. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to rest in my hotel. And of course, I needed some food. I needed to get something to eat. So I ordered room service. And what is the staple of room service in any hotel? Pizza. So I ordered a pizza. And sure enough, I was like, I'm just going to have a couple pieces. And then I'm going to eat the rest tomorrow after the marathon. It'll be just like a good reward. I ate the whole pizza. And the marathon did not turn out well. And what made it even worse was that the first time newbies, my brother and sister had a better time than me. Yeah, exactly. Embarrassing. Now, shame has always been a very good driver. Like wiggling out of the middle of the intersection it gets my attention, right? And that got my attention. So in the Chicago airport, I did something I had never done. I bought a diet book and never bought a diet book before. I bought a diet book. I literally read it on the plane. I'm ready to go. I get back here go to my grocery store Sunday night. I'm going to have my first Monday morning. I'm going to have my first Monday. It's perfect. It lines up perfect. You know, my binge was Saturday night, ran the marathon, come back here, everything's going. By Monday at lunchtime, I cannot stop eating. I'm eating foods that the book says not to eat. And I call Walter up. I call him up and I said, the guy that said he needed this, because the one good thing that I learned really well was to quit. You know, when things get difficult, that's what I do. I quit. I don't stick around. I quit. And that really has served me well in OA. It really has. It's like, do it your way as long as you want to do it. But when it doesn't work, quit. And I did. I quit. I called him. I said, what do I do? He said, let's go to a meeting. At the time, now this was maybe 2003, 2004, there was over 100 meetings, in-person meetings in the Valley. Can you believe that? Over 100 meetings in the Valley. So there were all times during the day. There was 20 to choose from almost every day of the week. And he's like, oh, yeah, let's go to this meeting. I'm like, I'll meet you there. And again, I didn't like it. It was uncomfortable, all those things. But you know what I did like? I liked the fellowship. I liked the fellowship. And, you know, we talked about those things. And then we shared the meeting. We talked about it. It was great. And we went to fellowship. And that was awesome. I really liked the fellowship, reasoning it out with other people. And that sense of aloneness really kind of disappeared. And I liked it. And so I started going. Now, I will tell you one experience that I had figuring out my abstinence and figuring out the phenomenon of craving, right? So here's my thinking, even in program. When I first got into OA, I told myself I couldn't eat pizza. I knew flour and sugar right away. Couldn't eat it. But then somebody had a pizza, right? And I'm like, you know what? How can I get this? Here's my little thinking. And it made complete sense for me to take the first bite. I said, if I eat the pizza right before I go to bed, my body won't know that I ate the pizza, so then it will not produce craving in my body, so then I will be okay. And then I won't eat anymore after tomorrow morning. I mean, now you say that now, and it's just insane thinking. It is absolute, but that's the kind of thinking that that's that strange mental blank spot they talk about when it comes to food. Where my thinking, the decision-making process works exceptionally well in other things, when it comes to food, it's warped. And so after that I got abstinence and figured it out and really was able to stick with it. And I got back down to my high school wrestling weight, and of course that's when I got the girlfriend, and then I got the job started turning into the career, everything was going really well. And then I started to not have so much time. You know, I didn't have as much time. The fellowship was definitely out because that's, you know, you've got the meeting in an hour and, you know, that's where the recovery's at. And then the fellowship, that's an extra hour and I'm not really sure what I get. Even though I like it, it's like, I don't really have time for that. And then even though I was sponsoring, there was no set kind of, there was no discipline about it. There was no teaching. It was like, hey, here's the food plan. Call me if you need me, right? Here's the steps. I will give you a list of questions for the steps. Do the steps on your own. And come back when you're done. And that's what I was shown. That's what, you know, I would take them through the 12 and 12. They would answer their questions. And if they didn't show back up again, then they were on their own. It was their fault. And so I was slowly, and what I like to call it is called the drift, right? I like to call the drift. If you leave me alone, if you leave me without action and constructive action, recovery action, I will start to drift. And the drift is always towards more. It is always towards more. That is where it's like a magnetic pull. You leave me without action and constructive recovery action, I will drift towards more food. The book is very clear about what you need to do to recover, and it's really action. And so, so sure enough, I started to drift. I started to go to less. Well, first of all, I would leave meetings early to get to spin class because I found out I love spin class. Spin class did for me exactly what a hamburger would do for me. It would shut my mind up for about 30 seconds because I could exhaust myself on that spin bike in 45 minutes to where I was drenched with sweat, and then my mind would be quiet. And I love that feeling. I just love the silence. And that's exactly what a Big Mac did for me. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it shut all the voices up and just gave me peace of mind. And so I was leaving. Meetings early to go to spin class. I was going to less and less meetings. I was doing less and less fellowship. I was still sending in my food. And my weight starts to go up because I'm starting to eat more. So here's the sneaky part for me about food. And that's why I need real clarity around my food, because I can trigger craving with just quantity. I can trigger craving, not with what he thought, not with, I mean, pizza, of course, is out. But what about that extra helping of A, B, or C? What about that extra helping, that extra, that second helping of vegetables or that second chicken breast or whatever it is? I can treat, because the more I eat, the more I want, right? And so I start to gain weight. And I, you know, again, everything on the outside except for the maybe 10 or 15 pounds I've gained is fine. And so I remember this day like it was yesterday. I was working on a job, and it was a very stressful job with people that were just, I just didn't mix with. And those little Entenmann donuts showed up, and I was just like, oh, and here's exactly like the book talks about. I recoiled from it from a hot flame. I said, no, I can't have that. And then my mind, it started working on it as the day went on, and more stress and less recovery. No outreach calls, of course, at this point. No connection. No being part of. And the disease just kind of slipped in the side door, and it said, you know what, Tim? You know, your program has been really shaky the last couple months. Yeah, I know you've got a fiance, and, you know, you've got this great career now, but your program has been really shaky. So here's what we're going to do. He goes, we're going to have one donut. And I go, no, we can't have a donut. He goes, that would be a clear break in abstinence, because just because now I'm technically abstinent now, right? I've got this technical abstinence started, this jargon around technical abstinence. And he goes, here's the thing, just be quiet, shh, take it easy, eat the donut, and you will break your abstinence. And then what you will do is you will go back to a meeting tomorrow. This will inspire you to go to a meeting tomorrow. Tell them you broke your abstinence. And then you will start over. So what I hear is one donut in one day. That's all I hear. I hear one donut and I'll start over tomorrow. I will start over tomorrow. Not a problem. So I ate that donut, and it wasn't just one donut. It was all the donuts. It was all the donuts and whatever else was there. I know it's funny, but understand this is how the disease approaches somebody that's not tethered, that the drift has started. And I can't see it coming. I believe the lie. Now, I believe it. And by the way, it wasn't just one day. It was 5 years. It was 5 years until I was willing to humble myself and come back and say, I think I made a mistake. Please help me. Right? So it wasn't just one donut in one day. It was all the donuts. It was 120-pound weight gain. And it was 5 years of my life. My wife was afraid of me. Now, we got married. You see the kid? You see the picture of the kid? All that? My wife was afraid of me because when I'm that guy in that last picture. You leave me unaided and unconstructively moving forward, I am that guy. I am the monster. And because if you get in the way of me and food, you're going to go. You have got to go. And so I don't know what happened. On May the 4th, 2009, something happened. My daughter was 6 months old, because that was about the biggest I was. My daughter was 6 months old. She was sleep trained. She was sleeping through the night. My wife and I were going to have a Netflix night. We got this was when there were still DVDs. You know, they were still sending out those DVDs. Whew, gotta pay myself. All right. So I told my wife, I'll go pick up the food. And of course, you know what that is. I mean, that's just a binge on the wheels, man. I'm going to go 14 different places. I will pick up that one thing that you want. But I'm going to get what I need, right? And I did that. I kept eating. I couldn't stop eating. And I remember, I could not stop eating. And I want to get that. It was not a matter of choice. It wasn't about willpower. As soon as there was any more room, I kept shoving it in. I could not stop. And so, again, what happened was somewhere in the middle of the night, I just eating so much, I threw up in my mouth. I threw up in my mouth and it woke me up in more ways than one. But it woke me up and I was like, and I went back to sleep at that moment. But something happened there. And really, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? I apologize. What is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? I have been given a great upbringing. There's problems for absolute sure. My parents did the best they could, but they loved me. And without a doubt, I knew that every step of the way. Right? They gave me a great education, the best education money could buy. If I could get into a school, they would provide it. I didn't get into good schools, but my brothers and sisters did, so they got it, you know. They gave me a top-notch work ethic. They gave me a good moral compass. I have been, and I can't stop eating. And I could pull nothing but defeat out of every turn in my life. I would get to a certain point. It's like running up a sandy hill. At a certain point, I just go, ah, screw it, and I just walk away. At that point, I knew that this was not going away. Now, the lie that I told myself as I got along in that 5-year relapse was that lie that kept ringing true. And what my dream was, my dream was, I'm going to lose the weight, and then I'm going to come back and tell you how I did it. And that was not what happened. That was not what I came into the room and I couldn't stop crying. I could not stop. I don't know why. I just was like, I couldn't stop crying. I went into the Sunday morning meeting. That's my home meeting, the 7:30 meeting in Studio City. And I was just like, that's where the hitters are. That's where the people that where you know, they know something about program. A lot of those men there and women there, they have what I want. And I will seek counsel from them. I will do what they say. And, it hasn't been... You can ask my wife. It hasn't been this great, glorious split off into the sunset ride, but it has been so much better than that 5 years was. And so, let's just come current. What I do today is, I sponsor a lot of guys. I sponsor people every day of the week. I am up at 5 a.m. every morning sponsoring, it has been the greatest gift. It is absolutely the secret sauce of this program, because when I stop thinking about Tim and the eye of Tim, and I am helping that next person and watching people recreate their lives is the most amazing thing in the world. To see guys that were homeless, living in their cars, stealing food, eating out of dumpsters, and now they have jobs. Now, you don't think a job is something big, but man, when you're coming from here, it is a big thing. They've got apartments. And to watch it come and happen for them, and then they're helping the next guy over in the corner and helping them, walking them through the process too. To see that happen, I guess the difference before was I wanted the solution so that I could leave. And now I know there is no leaving. This is where I fit. And so when I hold hands at the end of the meeting, I never close my eyes anymore. Because I want to remember you are my tribe because you saved my life. And if there's anything that I can do for you, you let me know because you have it. Because without this, I am that guy, that picture of that guy. And I don't want to be that guy anymore because I don't know that I get my wife back. I don't know that my 2 daughters stick around for that guy. And because, I just don't know. I don't know if that's in the cards. And I don't know if it's 10 years before I come back. So thank you very much for everything you've done for me, keeping these rooms open, getting them open, all those people online, Zoom, whatever it is, so that I could find the recovery that I need to help me one day at a time help the next person. So thank you very much. What do I do now? Okay. Okay, so this is the question time. Does anyone have questions? And I will repeat the questions. Yes. The question was, did my religious school help or hinder my finding a higher power in this program? It actually was very difficult for me. I guess at first I thought I had a higher power, but that was so far removed from me, and if I made a mistake, I might get turned into salt. So for me, that was a very scary higher power. And I don't know when this process started for me. I had to just say, it felt very disloyal for me to say, I got to put that God aside for now. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. But I have to put it aside for now. And my journey with the higher power began with something very simple. It began with the clock. I know it sounds so absurd, but for me, I was so afraid of being hungry that the clock, only in Hollywood movies does it go backwards. It my next meal just got 1 second closer, and it just happened again. It was stable and it was consistent. It wasn't capricious. It wasn't going to change. It was something I could believe in 100%, and that was enough to begin. That's where I could begin there, and then it slowly became. The group was my first one. whatever they said, my sponsor was whatever he said, I'll do. Okay, yeah. And then the clock was the journey away from something human. And then it was became like, I love toddlers. I just love. I feel joy. I just feel joy when I see toddlers. And that's exactly the way God looks at me. My God looks at me exactly like that. Even when I'm not doing the right thing. Even when I'm not doing the right thing. And so it was very difficult at first, but I didn't need to go to my, once I made the leap, I was okay with it. And it was okay for me. Yeah. That was a great question. Thank you. Oh, yes, sir. That's a great question. So when the negotiating with food starts to talk, then what do I do? What actions do I take? Well, I do a 10 step. So now, again, I know everybody has a little different version of the 10 step. The way I read the big book, it says when something comes up, you know, my job is to watch for anger, resentment, self-seeking, or frightened, right? My job is to watch. And what I could always do, I could never identify what it was, but I was always hungry. So at the beginning, I was always hungry. And I eat 5 times a day, 3 meals, 2 snacks, right? So I eat enough in 2 to 3 hours increments that I really should never be hungry. I should be hungry going into a meal. But if I'm hungry at another time, that to me is 911 emergency. So number one is I ask God to remove it. Number two is I call somebody. I pick up the phone and say, hey, listen, I'm hungry. And it's all right. I just ate dinner. I just ate dinner and I'm scared to death. I'm not going to make it to breakfast. You know, and then I try to find somebody I can help. Then it's because if you call the newcomer, believe me, they're dealing with something much bigger than your little brief moment of hunger. That newcomer is like, I have no idea how I'm going to make it, you know, and you've got experience. So to me, it's really doing that 10 step of asking God to remove it, talking over with somebody that's been down the road farther than me, and then turning my thoughts to that newcomer. So that a 10 step always helps me out, but it's a lot of it's the phone call. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Ryan, close over here. Thanks so much for your share. Really, your pitch. Like, I really related to, let me just ask the question. So, like, when you were first coming in, you know, you said, like, 2009, the day you came in after that binge, was it, like, immediately that day you were back in? Or was it still, like, you get, like, you know, 2 weeks, and then you were out for the day, 2 weeks, and you're out? I mean, that's where I'm at. Was it just like you were right back in it, or how did that process take?
So that's a really good question. So when I came back in from relapse, what did it look like in the beginning? Did I relapse a few times before I got it? It has been a while. I did relapse the first time I was in due to lack of understanding, but I had a real clear picture of what it was and what it wasn't. And I have added foods to my abstinence list. But I started off with very simple recreational sugar and flour. You know, I mean, if it was in a meal, then it wasn't a problem. But if it was something, you know, added sugar, added like, you know, candy or stuff like that, then that was out. And we did, again, as we went along, that's another question my sponsor asked me about 60 to 90 days in. He asked me a very important question, and I have no idea why I told him the truth. But he said, what have you put on your plate in the last couple months that as soon as you put it on your plate, you wanted a second helping of it? And I don't know why. I was like, maybe I'll get more. I really don't know. Because I would, you leave me on, I get afraid if you take food from me. Still to this day, I don't like food being taken from me. I still don't. That's why I pack all my food. I don't like feeling gypped. I really don't like feeling gypped. That's another word. That's another old school word. So I told him it was potatoes and rice. And he goes, well, Tim, those are alcoholic foods as well. Those are foods you get high with. Those are foods that you... And I'm like, well, what about brown rice? He goes, what about... He goes, now, Tim, now, he had been abstinent. At this time, he had been abstinent 10 years. He had got to his healthy body weight, and stayed there for 10 years. It wasn't like he was going up and down, playing with the food. You never heard any, there was never any question about his abstinence. And I'm like, okay, I'll trust you. And he goes, well, the potatoes and rice are out. And I'm like, even brown rice? He goes, yeah, even brown rice. So I don't know if brown rice is an alcoholic food for me, but guess what? I've got a great life in 14 years, and I don't need to find out. I don't need rice. I really don't need rice or potatoes. And so so that was another important discussion that I had with my sponsor. And I get scared, but I am part of this group of men that are like soldiers. They are there to support you, especially when you're new, to walk you through those scary times. Especially when you're new, because it is, you're like, oh, I'm afraid and I want more. And it's always, I'm always hungry. I'm always hungry. You know, I don't know how I'm going to make it the next 2 hours. Well, I'd make a lot of phone calls. I pick up that phone a lot. And if the other person on the other end of the line has had my experience, they'll know exactly what to say. They'll know exactly what to say. And guess what? It always works. 100% of the time, you talk to somebody on the other end of that phone, I can't explain it, but the hunger goes away. The hunger goes away, and it works 100% of the time. But you've got to take the action. So I don't remember it being stops and starts. I at least that's the story I tell myself. You might have to check with my sponsor. But my date, I think, is pretty close to when I came back in. Yes?
Thanks. I want to ask, when you find yourself in these situations now, when you were speaking in the past, these things where it no longer becomes new, the newness and the novelty wears off, how do you handle that?
That's a great question. So how do I handle when the newness of something isn't there? So for me, going back to my current, because there's not much new in these meetings. Let's be honest, right? We don't hear a lot of new stuff in here. But guess what? You can always give something here. So, and I think for me, I've been lucky. A lot of men have asked me to sponsor them. So I'm of service at all levels. I'm of service at the group level. I'm of service at the above level, and I'm of service in sponsorship. And so the opportunity to give, because what I didn't get, what I never heard, and again, I'm not saying that it wasn't said. What I did not hear was 10, 11, and 12. Continue, seek, and carry. Continue, seek, and carry. Continue to keep it square. Continue to keep it right. Seek your higher power. Seek that guidance. That, to me, the 11th step is all vision work. It's all about you envisioning you and your higher power throughout the day. Because if you read it in the big book, it's all about sitting there. You don't even get up until the end of that reading. You don't even leave the chair. So all that reading is about you thinking about you and your higher power walking through your day and when problems occur. It's all about that. That gets exciting. When you start to and put how you're going to walk through a difficult situation with your higher power, that all of a sudden gets exciting because now you're approaching something and it's brand new. It's not the same old thing. It's a brand new thing because now you've got this third entity there. You've developed this relationship with your higher power, and then you carry this message into all, not just in sponsorship, but in all areas. And if you read the family afterward, to the wives, and to the employers, the three most biggest areas of our lives, our families, our relationships, and our jobs. So it tells us exactly where to work these things out and how to be in all of our areas of our lives. I mean, the directions are right there. They're hard. It's a high standard. They really do. If you look, you start to get into very clear-cut directions on how to live your life. And so now it isn't just my life, and it's not something that I get. It's now I'm a giver. I was a taker when I came in. I would take all of mine and all of yours, too. If I could get away with it, I would take all of yours. And now I must give. I've taken my fair share and more than enough, and now it's my turn to give. So now it's brand new. Now I'm asking my higher power, now, hey, where do you want? I wouldn't be here unless asked to be here. Yeah. So it's just a perspective shift, but I think it's a very important perspective shift, and it keeps me focused in that direction of action. Because there's nothing left to take here. After you're here a while, there's nothing left to take. You got to give. Yes.
What advice would you give yourself when you first came in the rooms after relapse?
What advice would I give myself? What advice would I give myself just coming back from relapse? That's a good question. Your sponsor knows you better than you know you. Yeah. Shut up and do what you're told. I had all these great ideas, and I think I know me better than anyone else does. But I don't see the me that's killing me. I don't see, and I'll just, I was just talking to a woman over, when I was coming over the hill, driving over here, she wants me to do this. I'm not losing weight, and she wants to take more food from me. I'm like, yeah, that's what we do. I know it's hard. But, and I'm glad you're making this call. But that's they know you better than you know you. They know we're escape artists. They can see it. I envision my sponsor as a sniper. Really? I mean, he is up in the crow's nest. He is up looking at the jungle of Tim. Now I'm in there with a machete chopping around. I can't see shit. Sorry. See, I keep swearing. Sorry. I can't see this stuff, right? So I can't see it, but he can. And if I listen, now my job is to ask the questions, because he's not anymore. Now, he would tell me when I was new. He would tell me. Great. He doesn't tell me anymore. I got to ask. So now I've got to be, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And as long as I'm willing to talk about it, it's generally not a problem. He's like, yeah, it's a good idea. But it's when I got to, no, I don't want to talk about this. He's like, yeah, we got to talk about that. So, yeah, they know you better than you know you. And that is a hard thing, to surrender that control, that I mess up food each and every time. The drift becomes, especially with food, it's really fast. It is so subtle and very fast. Yeah. That is a great question. I like that question. Yes. How much time? 1 minute left. There we go.
Thanks so much. Great share. Could you talk about how you find moderation exercise now from the Friday morning?
How do I find moderation with exercise? So, I didn't exercise for 2 years. I could not do it. I could not do it sanely. And my sponsor said, we're not doing it. And that's a hard thing to argue against. But I just listened to him. I said, okay. He goes, can you go out and just take a walk? I'm like, no, I don't want to take a walk. I want to run all these miles. He goes, well, then you can't do it. And so now we just, I did a 100-mile bike ride in abstinence. Again, we just worked it out together. Now I do a little bit of running. You know, that has kind of gone away, that obsession, the 12 steps in being of service has really calmed those voices down. Exactly what I did with that exercise, it was just to drive away the voices. The work and the sponsorship and the softening of me, you know, has taken place, so all the voices aren't there anymore. So it's now easy for me to moderate. So thank you very much.